Engineering News, the most widely read publication in biotechnology, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network. Gen's Editor-in-Chief John Sterling talks to Dr. Thomas Stossel of Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. The topic? Life science collaborations between academia and industry. Is there an inherent conflict of interest?
Dr. Thomas Stossel is co-director of the Hematology Division at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He was educated at Princeton and the Harvard Medical School, and trained in internal medicine at the Massachusetts General Hospital and in hematology at Boston Children's and Peter Bent Brigham Hospitals. Dr. Stossel was president of the American Society for Clinical Investigation and editor-in-chief of its Journal of Clinical Investigation. One of his main policy interests is physician and researcher interactions with private industry. Dr. Stossel, why are academic industry life science partnerships important to basic research and clinical medicine?
Well, you can turn the question around. Why? What's not to like about them? What, there's absolutely a score of reasons why they're important at all ends of basic research and clinical medicine. We should start by saying that only industry actually delivers products to people. And that being the case, they can and should access any and all information, and a lot of that information does come from academic research. It's not just academic, it's physicians, and practicing physicians should be interacting with industry because as you go from the front end of discovery and early development, that as products move into the clinic or attempt to move into the clinic, physicians do the testing. Physicians advise companies on what the needs are, advise them about the best way to perform trials. And you get to the back end, and there's a huge education need, and physicians and scientists can help educate the public on about the uses of new products. And then even unlocking investment is enormously important because, especially now, the venture capital is becoming relatively risk adverse, and so they need professionals to advise them about how best to invest their funds, and those funds then are put to good use in product development.
Now, earlier this year, you co-authored an opinion piece in the Washington Post entitled, "What's Wrong with Money in Science?" What were the main points you were trying to make in that article?
The article was actually representative of a number of articles that I've written in professional journals and in the lay press relating to this issue of what I call the medical anti-industrial complex, is that a strange aversion to the role of business in bringing good products to people. And this particular article addressed an issue that has to do with who should advise the FDA. And the FDA works long and hard with companies address how they develop products, and at the end of the process, which is only one of many steps, what are called FDA advisory panels of experts, usually academics, weigh in on whether a product should be approved or not. And it's not binding, it's just a recommendation. And the anti-industrial complex entrepreneurs are absolutely obsessed with the idea that no one who serves on one of those FDA advisory panels should have any contact with industry, certainly particularly industries that are developing products related to what's being discussed. And so you end up with a very strange situation where you have the second best and not so bright, if these people get their way, that would be advising the FDA, because it's the people who have the most knowledge and the most experience are most likely to be involved with companies. So what the article was about is that Public Citizen, which, as you know, is the is an anti-industry lobbying group, thought that they could find a smoking gun that would show that individuals with conflicts of interest would always vote in favor of products. And in fact, they massaged the data statistically every way that they could. They analyzed FDA panel decisions. And because now the industry relationships of advisors are in the public domain, and they couldn't find any evidence that there was such a bias. So they wrote an article and submitted it, and it was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, where they, despite the fact that the data was negative, they were allowed to speculate why the bias is a bad thing. And our article in the Washington Post basically took them to task for that.
I see. Now, why do you think some people in the federal government, the media, and at academic institutions believe that financial conflicts of interest are a given in such university industry partnerships?
Well, it's hard to know. I can't. They are speculate about people's motives, and I think that's inappropriate. But it's best I can guess. It's a combination of inexperience, ignorance, apathy, envy, and self-aggrandizement. That if we don't have ethical problems, then there's no reason for ethicists to exist.
Now, you've written that transparency or disclosure of company sponsorship of academic research or education is an invasion of personal privacy. How so?
Well, it's not. I don't say that in that transparency and disclosure in and of itself is necessarily an invasion of personal privacy. That transparency and disclosure can be good things. What I really mean is that intrusive disclosure is a problem, and that is where things have gone. That there's been a ramping up, an escalation in the required disclosure requirements. We used to mention our sponsors to honor them. I mean, now it's a black box warning, so that the reader or the listener can discount our word and our work. And whereas it used to be that one would disclose specific sponsors of a specific study, one is now asked to disclose every relationship that one has had with a commercial entity, and people far from what exactly you do make the decision about whether it's relevant or not. Now, the disclosure is also very strangely selective because it is only rigorous in terms of commercial connections. 80% of the healthcare dollar is in hospitals and doctor services, and yet those are exempt from these disclosure requirements. And the assumption that that only industry relationships are problematic is a gross distortion.
I see. Now, you've talked about red light and yellow light regulation of academic research. What do you mean by these terms, and how do they impact the work of life scientists?
Well, let's start with the yellow light regulation. You have a car, and there are speed limits. So basically what it says is the car, it's okay if the car exceeds the speed limit. It's just you're not supposed to do it. And a red light regulation would say, you can't own a car that exceeds the speed limit. Now, that's problematic because speed limits vary from place to place and time to time. And the equivalent of a red light regulation in life sciences is an absolute prohibition about what you can or cannot do. So, for example, researchers at the National Institutes of Health and the intramural scientists cannot consult for companies. That's an absolute red light regulation. It can't get any clearer than that. And the consequence of that is companies don't have the benefit of some of our leading scientists helping them to develop products. Many universities have very severe rules about ownership of inventors' ownership of technology and that they would then do research on. You cannot have equity and sponsored research. And this takes away a major incentive that was a great success in the early days of the biotechnology industry, where wonderful products were developed and nothing bad happened. So it's red light regulation is in addition to being a real invasion of freedom and confiscation of public property, is almost by definition has to impede product development.
Now, when you look at this, all these issues we're talking about and things going in at NIH and other institutes, what is the evidence for and against this whole idea that financial conflicts of interest are a major problem in academic industry partnerships?
Well, unless I'm missing something, there's precious little evidence that it's a problem, other than an emotional one, some kind of ascetic imperative, envy against other people's profits. When you drill down and look for actual evidence of harm, other than isolated incidents, it's simply not there. And the idea that conflicts of interest are causing bias and impairing rigor, the claims to that effect contradict the very rigor that supposedly is being protected, because no controls are brought up in these comparisons. In other words, you need to know when bad things happen. Are more bad things happening, adverse incidents, in the context of commercial sponsorship or commercial involvement than in its absence? And the fact is, there is no evidence to that effect. Indeed, not a single case of misconduct, of research misconduct that's been reported to the Office of Research Integrity of the NIH has involved a company. Companies have all kinds of reasons for not tolerating misconduct. It's hard enough to get a product approved. And so it seems it's really a pretty open and shut case. And I've made this point, and nobody has rebutted it. Nobody has rebutted it on the facts. They only argue it on the basis of ideology. Now, when we get in, there is another aspect to this that's softer, and that has to do with the idea that company marketing distorts the appropriate use of products. There's a tendency to use newer, more expensive products, and there's probably a grain of truth to that, but what isn't established in any way is that on balance that this is harmful, that you can't prescribe what you've never heard of, and there is vast underutilization of products that patients should be having access to. So the critics have to show that on balance these financial incentives are causing more harm than good.
Now what we've just been discussing, along with the NIH mandates on open access to science journals, and also the degree to which NIH can scientists can collaborate with industry, have led some to view these actions as a form of government control of science. Now, this in itself is in addition to the current ban on federal funding for embryonic stem cell research, and to talk of potential price controls for new therapeutics and diagnostics that are developed by industry. Do you see this as a form of government attempting to control scientific research?
No. Government, after all, has pretty limited roles. And what I see it as, efforts of interested parties to try to co-opt the power of government to promote their pet projects. So these examples you've given actually are each one is a little bit different. So open access is what you mentioned first. I personally think is a terrible idea. Some science celebrities picked up on this, and I think it reflects a failure to understand what scientific communication really is. Journals were not established for the public. Journals were established for professionals to communicate with one another, and they've been a great thing. But over the years, they've evolved. And in the last half century, as science has gotten bigger and bigger, there's a potential for, has been a potential for journals to be very profitable. And I think this has offended people who don't understand that everything has to be paid for, and that the profitability of some journals has been a response to a good understanding of the vanity of scientists and how they think and how they try to publicize their output and productivity, and it's led to considerable variety in the outlets that researchers have to get their information out. To substitute that with a sort of one-size-fits-all government mechanism would be a huge mistake, and especially at a time when there's limited funding for research, to squander it on publishing seems like a bad idea. Now, the stem cell thing is also a different animal because, after all, the government isn't the only source of research funding. It's been a big one, and it's been a very good thing, but what many of my colleagues don't understand is that government support of science, of research, it's not an entitlement. In fact, we seem to forget all the time that the reason the public asks the government to underwrite research is because it leads to better products, things that help people. And so it's not for scientists to simply amuse themselves. But what we have to keep in mind is when we ask the public to do something, we're dealing with politics, and we're dealing with the diversity of our culture and people of different persuasion. And while I personally wish that the government could support embryonic stem cell research, I have to accept the fact that if we're going to ask the public to support us, that we have to be solicitous of and use of that diversity that the public represents. Then you mentioned price controls. That sort of goes back to another terrible idea. It's a wishful thinking that when countries where prices are controlled, no drugs are developed. But again, that government is what the political will of the people, or government does what the political will of the people force it to do. And so, I don't see it as a government conspiracy. I see it as the political process driving in those directions.
I see.
Is that clear?
Yeah, it sure is. Thank you. Hey, now my final question is really twofold. Oh, getting back to this academic industry partnerships. One, what's the best way to address concerns over perceived or real, sometimes conflicts of interest issues in academic industry partnerships? And two, to what degree should government have a say in the funding of an actual carrying out of scientific research in the United States?
Well, with respect to the first question, I think there needs to be much more balance in the debate about conflict of interest. The points of view that I represent haven't been heard at all. There's been 20 years of unopposed airtime from the anti-industry complex. And so I put it to my colleagues who agree with my point of view, if there are any, that they need to step up to the plate and be heard. Many of the people who are oppose industry and who are promoting the evils of conflict of interest don't have a particularly distinguished track record in science or in product development. Some do, but not really product development. And people who have that distinction need to use their credibility to be heard. I think the going back to the red light and the yellow light situation, that we should have less red light regulation. When the model of research misconduct has been a pretty good one. We have a fairly narrow definition of misconduct. When people misbehave, we need to be with due process, diligent in getting the information, and if necessary, punishing people. But I think that to try to sanitize research with prophylactic law, we're just going to have a lot less research. And I think there's already a trend in that direction. And then as far as government's concerned, that's just what I said before. I mean, the government's role is to protect us. I would say probably the most intrusive government role in research right now is the FDA. And the FDA really is the gate, decides what products get out. And the political process, the activism, the anti-industry movement has it really forces the FDA to be more and more cautious and to err on the side of caution. And, you know, as though there is no such thing as a risk-free life. Going back to the car analogy, more people are killed driving fast cars, than were killed by Vioxx or these other high-profile drug cases. So I think it's a question of getting balance and a better risk assessment.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. Now we'd like to get your opinion about academic industry collaborations in the life sciences. Please go to www.genengnews.com/blog and answer the following question. Should collaborations between biotech or pharmaceutical companies and academic centers be considered as conflicts of interest? If so, why? If not, why not? Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, be sure to visit our website at www.genengnews.com. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghaus saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next Thursday.